Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. I just poured some coffee, and let's sit back and enjoy an hour together. This is an advantage of Zoom. If Kip and Ron, you're having a glass of Burgundy, I can't see it. Nobody else can see it, so you're good. I want to mention a couple of things I'm going to highlight today because of some questions that came in early on. Actually, the first two questions that came in when I asked for those responses were about burnout, so I'm going to discuss that in just a bit, along with some sort of cousins of burnout, choking, self-handicap, sandbagging, and some research on resilience that it can add to effectiveness in each of these issues. One thing also, in terms of the questions I got, that I want to be sure that we cover these. Some of you ask about teaching your clients. I want to emphasize that's not what we do in coaching. We don't teach. We don't train. Now, we do those things, but with a client, with a mentor coaching client, we're going to engage in a coaching conversation, and the client determines the focus, and you're the catalyst. You're not ghostwriting a story. You're not teaching, training. You may add some things, but the client is always the point of reference in that. So I wanted to clarify for that concept especially. So questions or thoughts about anything that's unclear or that you'd like to talk a bit more about before we move into the material in this seminar on peak performance under pressure? I want to remind you, too, that I mentioned we'd have an extra 10 or 15 minutes of discussion at the end of next seminar after the top of the hour, so we can just kind of hang out, and I want to be sure that any of your questions or clarifications are really addressed, or that we'll have a chance just to talk and develop some ideas or maybe some applications of this. So remember that if you have time. It'll be a fun discussion and a bit more time when it's not so pushed at the beginning and the end of each of the seminars. Questions, thoughts, things that might be helpful to talk about just briefly at this point? And thank you for managing the background noise, everyone. No questions? I could not have been that clear. Any major surprise or thing you're taking away that you want to share, or maybe even want to develop a bit more in our remaining two seminars? Okay, you guys are going to help me feel very lonely here, so no questions, no comments, nothing, no input, nothing in the hopper right now. Am I clear? Okay, well, I'll reserve some time at the end for discussion. So I'll put us on lecture mode, and we're off and away. We're going to talk about peak performance under pressure. And first, let's talk about an optimum performance mindset. Remember, we talked about how your brain can't tell the difference between excitement and anxiety. And let's expand that. The physiological response in your body to excitement and to fear are exactly the same, mind and brain. Your body, as well as your brain, doesn't know the difference. The only difference between excitement and fear is what your brain tells you and then what you do with that in terms of how you frame it. So this is the key in working with a client. This is the key in dealing with things yourself. With a response of fear or anxiety, if we frame it as fear and anxiety, then we search for what's wrong and look at how do we deal with that, how do we protect ourselves, how do we deal with danger. This association creates closure, and a negative meaning reads as fear. So this is what we do in coaching with a client who begins with talking about problems or talking about something they're afraid of or anxious about. What's the possibility here? To look at reframing it as excitement, because when we look at possibility, that opens new pathways and networks potentially in our brain. When you look at a problem, you go down an already created route. That's already hardwired. Every time you re-enter a problem, even ostensibly to find a better answer or work out a solution, it etches it further. So, just before you begin a task in which you've increased activation of alertness, maybe heart racing, sweaty palms, instead of automatically linking anxiety or fear and looking for what caused it or what can go wrong, substitute the framing of, I'm excited, I'm ready. Reframe to ask, why am I ready to do this? How am I going to do it? This provides a positive framework of anticipatory readiness. What's the opportunity here? This frames the brain context of excitement rather than anxiety or fear to determine how you proceed. Performance anxiety is an indication, in one sense, of how much you care both about performance and outcomes. It's normal, even necessary, to have activation as preparation for optimal performance. Frame the excitement or the anxiety, and it determines how you're going to proceed. Consider the activation rather than anxiety as excitement and your mind and body preparing itself to perform, then move with successful ways that you've practiced. A key to consistent performance is to electively enter, to determine yourself entering and sustaining an optimum state of mind for a performance task. Preparation includes self-reflection to identify and monitor the specific state of mind for optimum performance. Consistency then requires a systematic strategy to remain grounded and centered so that no subsequent experience or event disrupts that state of flow, and a way to reboot if derailed. One pro athlete I worked with, an all-pro cornerback, because football is an episodic sport and the performance zone is not a natural flow like basketball. We've touched on this before, but I wanted to remind you again of how he gets back in state, back in that performance zone after every play, because the greatest challenge is doing really well or doing really bad on a play. Because when you're excited, you're a bit off the chart. You've done something really spectacular, and it's been recognized, or something really bad. So the challenge is to get back in the performance zone, the practiced performance zone for each. So his simple statement to himself after every play is reboot. And that's his cue. It automatically gets him centered and grounded in an optimum state. So a significant number of studies find the most common psychological characteristics of an optimum performance state as these five. Now, these five are in your outline. Confidence with positive expectations about performance. Full concentration with focus on the present, the immediate task. A strong determination and commitment. Feeling relaxed but energized. That's a sweet spot. Mental toughness of determined focus under pressure. Mastery of all aspects of pressure situations means being aware of emotional triggers, of anything that can derail thoughts, feelings, events, anything that would disrupt focus and state, including extreme success or extreme failure. We're going to return to how to manage extreme success in our final seminar. That's something that I don't think we talk enough about in coaching. A routine is effective because when it's repeated enough, the brain creates a neuronal pathway and network to make it a default mode. It becomes automatic. It's hardwired. Studies have shown that athletes who use a pre-performance routine perform better than those who don't. They attend to getting in state. Same with coaches. Before you receive a call from your client or connect with your client or your group or anything you do, get grounded and centered. Have a quick way to do this. This systematic entry into an optimum performance state of mind ensures access to the software specific to the deliberate practice and execution of the specific skill. So a routine can both guide focus and enhance a sense of effectiveness and mastery to execute a best plan of action throughout a performance. A brief mantra before a keynote is another example. Now here's a concept that comes from sports science, but it's something that is a real important application of focus, which we talk about in a number of ways. The quiet eye concept is a strategy of attentional control. The quiet eye is a selective focus prior to the execution of a practice skill. It's a selective focus on the most significant part of a target. Now, that's going to have some application, but in a different way, say in coaching. The quiet eye is the final step before initiating any important performance sequence. It's been shown to be especially important when performing under pressure. So here's some research and then an example. Eye-tracking research on the quiet eye shows that for a precise motor task like free throw shooting, putting, tying a surgical knot, experts maintain quiet eye 62% longer than non-experts. They don't linger, it's just they immediately focus and sustain the focus. Quiet eye focus specifically increases precision. Dr. Joan Vickers, professor of kinesiology at University of Calgary, showed a free throw accuracy increase by 22% after quiet eye training. It doesn't take any longer, it's just more specifically focused. In this example, she emphasized, and listen for the parallel for what you do in mentor coaching, she emphasized to specifically focus on a single spot on the hoop itself, such as midway between the front and center, and continue to do so through the shot. Begin at least a full second before initiating the shot and not shift eye focus even for a nanosecond. A quick fluid motion of the shot without losing focus on the quiet eye spot becomes most successful. And think about the equivalent here of really focusing on your client's story and what they specifically determine that you'll focus on. Academic and business performers can learn a great deal from research in athletic setting to apply this quiet eye concept. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain and has the functional role of readying the entire system for the next step. Quiet eye training enhances the default motor system execution of skills for a specific target. Sports science shows the benefits of choosing the best visual target for purposeful and goal-directed eye movements. Now, think about in listening to a client's story, that's the auditory focus on their specific focus. For example, when basketball players miss free shots, they often instantaneously move focus from the rim where the ball, from the rim to where the ball is going to actually look at the ball itself. And this causes mistakes. When soccer players miss a penalty shot, it's been found that they instantly compromise their focus from the destination at a specific spot just inside the goalpost to the goalkeeper, which converts the specificity of the ultimate target of scoring the goal to something else entirely. Or an executive is sidetracked by an emotional reaction to a colleague. Or your client says something in the focus that reminds you of something and you want to give some advice. Or you are distracted for a moment by the content rather than staying with the process of what the client wants to focus on and where they want to get to. So let's talk now a bit about self-talk and peak performance. I'd like you to think for a minute about your last self-talk. After some kind of stimulus or some kind of prompt, what did you say to yourself that was totally between you and you? Let me tell you a brief case illustration. A CEO I called Dan had a tragedy at his company, a serious accident with on-the-job injuries and a death at one of the operating sites. He was not directly involved, but it all came to him as CEO. In the 3 months since the accident, he had stress-related symptoms, losing sleep, depleted energy, preoccupation with safety. He recognized that his responses hampered his effectiveness as an executive and his ability to provide the leadership that his company needed. And he also recognized, as we looked at it more closely, how this was contagious, as any mood or state of mind is, to the immediate people in his executive suite, and how that may be filtering down beyond those offices. I asked Dan what went through his mind the moment he woke up. I asked for that specific day, not a general, but today. His answer, what could go wrong today? I said, what else? He described questions about what he could do for his company, how he could not feel helpless, how could he ensure the group that there would be no more accidents, or how he could mitigate possible future danger, all of which, of course, are negative and focus on the tragedy. He recognized that the mindset he began each day for the 3 months since the event had been essentially the same, and he had set the tone for both himself and his corporation. His concern, he recognized even more, had permeated not only his executive team, but to employees. He knew he had to do something different, but he wasn't quite sure what it was, because nothing seemed to work for very long. We began with a very simple approach. I suggested he try something different. I explained that we're always asking ourselves questions, whether or not we're even conscious of them, from the instant we wake up. And this internal conversation boots up, sets in motion a mindset to initiate the day. This inner dialogue, this kind of self-talk, is most often unconscious, but at stressful times, it can move to the foreground with the questions of what's going to happen today? Will I be able to handle it? What kind of things am I afraid of now? I suggested that sometime during the day or evening, before he went to bed, that he write down three questions that would put him in an empowered, positive state of mind, questions that would focus on his effectiveness, on what he could actually do and be effective in doing, rather than what happened in the past, which he couldn't do anything about it at this point. Questions that would focus on his effectiveness to instantly boot up a state of mind of confidence and mastery for now and next, and to answer those questions each morning as soon as he woke up. The next week at our session, he immediately reported the difference those questions had made. He recognized he had previously begun every day with negative self-talk and had created a mindset of lack of confidence and stress, especially at the things he could no longer now do anything about. And with that mindset, he processed the remainder of the day, or at least the first part of the day, and he recognized how contagious it was in his organization. He knew that was not what had created his successes. By shifting consciously to this positive framework and mindset, he booted up an entire software system that built on itself throughout the day. This initial framing of his self-narrative to direct the power of focus to launch a positive state of mind to engage the day became a model that he had passed on directly and indirectly to his organization. He noticed within days the impact it had on his executive team and how this change trickled down through his organization. Self-talk becomes an internal dialogue that can build confidence and create affirmations that can directly enhance performance. Self-talk should not counter the negative because that engages the negative. Remember, the unconscious can't tell the difference between positive or negative, just the focus. But focus on the positive and the empowering. Remember, we know from neuroscience and quantum mechanics, we get what we focus on. A positive self-talk in the present moment immediately replaces negative focus. It's important to recognize that a different set of strategies, including self-talk and affirmations, will be needed in different performance arenas. In athletics, a runner may need a focus phrase of powerful and steady, or keep your pace during longer races, or an I am the storm to keep from knocking off early for a single malt and cigar. That's a self-statement. The focus phrase needs to fit the endeavor. A different example to more effectively get to sleep at night may be the phrase, relax to sleep. So be sure your focus and your phrase fit the task. It's been shown repeatedly that self-talk can enhance performance. To be most effective, self-talk must be brief, specific, and focused. If you use a phrase, maybe up to 3 words, an initial focus phrase can instantly evoke a state of mind that's ideally matched for the task at hand, or to be a simple gesture. Now, the stories we tell ourselves, our self-talk of internal conversation, often frames our experience and can either sustain it or short-circuit it. Self-awareness becomes a crucial component in both monitoring and understanding this process. Now, if you have your outline, get ready to outline or underline this sentence. If you don't have your outline, get ready to write it. The most common reason you don't get what you want is the story you tell yourself about why you can't have it. Self-talk can enhance resilience and facilitate rebound from failure. From a different perspective, as you know, I love to bring together different bodies of work that can apply and enhance what we do in mentor coaching. This is from 2 engineering professionals and professors, actually, David Franklin, Daniel Wolpert. They've identified 5 mechanisms of brain operation when someone successfully bounces back from failure. Each of these 5 brain mechanisms has a specific corresponding brain function to allow us to directly access an inner dialogue for self-talk to rebound from failure with resistance to transform to success. So I'm going to tell you these, not that you're going to pass this on to clients or teach them or train them, but for your own reference and to consider what you may find in your own professional story that may be useful. 1, redirect negative feedback. Whether external or internal, it focuses energy in the brain in a negative way if you have negative feedback. So a reflection question, what can I learn from this? What are the possibilities here? Rather than the problems or to stay with the negativity. 2, the principle, obstacles are created. Consider, the obstacle you're experiencing is not something external that you simply need to strategize a way to avoid or overcome, but that the obstacle is not there until you create it by the way you see or frame something. To say this in a different way, an obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. And here's the underlying part. when you're ready to consider that you're creating the obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. So a self-reflection question here. What would it be like to not create the obstacle and instead put the energy into what I want? 3, use systemic forecasting. We each use invisible brain algorithms to predict the future. Our brain creates new pathways and networks for anything we repeat, so it develops a default mode to save energy. These hardwired patterns become predictive because they create the story that we anticipate even unconsciously. To preempt this automatic system, we have to consciously self-reflect to see, first, if the software developed at an earlier time and place is applicable for the current situation. Or, and if it is, that's great because your brain's got that down. You're ready to do the default mode. Or if it's outdated and we need to predict and respond differently. So a self-reflection question here, is my usual pattern optimum for this current situation? 4, assess the current model. Self-reflect to assess the effectiveness of what you're doing and if it's working. This requires, at times, disruption of automatic expectations and not continuing to inhabit the story that you want to believe. So the self-reflection question, is this plan really working or not? And 5, the output channel is essential. No matter how much we acquire information, study, and learn, it's by putting it into action, the output channel, that we not only enhance effectiveness, but actually create a performance memory. Remember the story I told you briefly about the research at University of Waterloo. Two groups read the same passage in a book. One read it silently. One read it out loud. They took a test. One's that read it out loud did 40% better on the test than the ones who read it silently. Use the output channel. The self-reflection question here, what do I next need to put into action? So let's look now at performing under pressure. All teams, from business organizations to sports, like to think they do their best when the stakes are highest, when the future rests on the immediate outcome. But that's really not how it happens. How you handle yourself in difficult and challenging moments determines success more than how you handle yourself in normal times. In extensive studies of teams of all sorts, academic, sports, a variety of teams, management, Professor Heidi Gardner at Harvard saw 3 performance pressure patterns that compromised results. When teams from sports to executive become caught up in the risk of failure rather than the pursuit of excellence, they revert to standard and safe practices instead of looking for original solutions, to the default mode rather than stick to the game plan of growth and expansion. Secondly, when teams face significant performance pressure, they tend to defer to high-status members rather than using expert members and specific expert information. And 3, when an individual team fails to perform well when strongly favored, or squanders a big lead in an important event due to excessive pressure. This is a group she especially studied. Research on performing under pressure consistently shows that most people perform below their capacity when it matters the most, when they're under pressure. This occurs in instances ranging from parallel parking in a driving test. This was my last performance coaching client was referred to me by his parents an outstanding young man, but he had screwed up on parallel parking and realized that that was kind of the tip of the iceberg of some other things. This occurs in instances ranging from a big job interview to a major business deal to sports and other kinds of applications. Pressure erodes behavioral skills and our ability to perform unless it's managed in an informed, systematic way. Here are three, I think, simple definitions that can help us in this discussion. Stress is a situation where there are too many demands, too few resources to meet the demands, like energy, time, or money. Pressure results from the significance we give a situation, the expectations we place on our performance, and the stake that we see in the outcome. State of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. We have many different software programs. When we practice in the same program that we perform, that's dynamite. State of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, and behavioral patterns that engage, ideally, in deliberate practice. Success most often has to do with how we manage our internal state under pressure-inducing circumstances. Those who develop pressure management strategies create optimal performance. Without those strategies and in pressure situations, focus can become narrowed or diverted and result in a range from impulsivity to mental rigidity or simply just being off your performance game. So, how can you develop resilience in performance? I think this is a quote by Dean Becker included in your outline. More than education, more than experience, more than training, a person's level of resilience will determine who succeeds and who fails. This is true in the cancer ward. It's true in the Olympics. It's true in the boardroom. Here's a brief story to illustrate an application of this. Theo Epstein guided the Boston Red Sox to their first World Series victory in 86 years. Then in 2011, he agreed to lead the Chicago Cubs, whose last World Series championship was in 1908. The Cubs then won in 2016, 108 years later. Widely touted as having an innate and rare intelligence to deconstruct a situation to its simplest form and generate strategies, Epstein was asked how he decides what he looks for in putting together a team. He indicated that he scouts the person more than the player. Epstein said the first thing he wants to know about any potential player is this. How has he handled adversity? Resilience grows by converting mistakes into lessons. By reflecting on and learning from mistakes, we convert a regrettable experience into a learning experience. Resilience is the ability to modulate and constructively harness a stress response, essential to both physical and mental health, and, of course, performance. Success in any arena hinges on resilience. Management of setbacks to productively progress becomes an essential process of optimal performance. Persistence towards a goal in the face of challenges characterizes success for athletes to executives to artists to coaches and to clients. A resilient individual is not someone who avoids stress, but someone who learns how to effectively master it and optimize performance while doing so. So, there are four ways to boost resilience. Four strategies, and this is a compilation of a number of studies. It's the simplest I can talk, so get ready. Reinterpret any negative event, reframing, in other words. Enhancing positive emotions, looking at what the possibility, the excitement is. Becoming physically fit. Maintaining a supportive social network to create and imitate resilience role models. The system, the context is important, externally as well as internally. The ability to regulate states of mind and manage emotions is central to establishing resilience. Two approaches demonstrated in recent research to regulate states of mind and enhance resilience are, and hang with me for this, and I'll explain it, cognitive reappraisal and mindfulness meditation. Some of you have heard of this. Cognitive reappraisal simply means reframing from a negative to a positive, as we just talked a bit ago, from problem to possibility, in order to reinterpret the meaning of an adverse event, to see it as challenge, as exciting, as opportunity. A Mount Sinai School of Medicine study of Vietnam prisoners of war found that those who had actively reappraised their imprisonment to find meaningful ways in which to grow stronger and more resilient were by far the most adaptive. Mindfulness meditation focuses, as you know, on how to get grounded and centered in the present moment, not dwelling on the past, not fretting about the future, not engaging any thought that naturally occurs. It's been associated with improved ability to focus, and it's a model for focus because you focus on your breath in and out of your body. Remember, as we talked about this last time, it's been associated with improved ability to focus, increased flexibility of thinking, and greater psychological well-being. Both cognitive reappraisal and mindfulness meditation have been shown to increase activation of the left prefrontal cortex. It's a brain activation pattern that's associated with greater emotional control and balance, boost of positive emotions, and even faster recovery from uncomfortable feelings. So here's a quick version of mindfulness meditation. The acronym is STOP. S-T-O-P. Stop. Take a breath. Observe your experience as you're focusing on the breath. Proceed. Recent articles in the Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind, as I mentioned much earlier, indicate that regulation of state of mind and self-reflection of executives is the most important quality for their excellence of performance. And that's only because executives were the ones that were studied. I believe that's the case for everyone. Mindfulness and meditation become a micro practice in which a leader guides the energy of another or group to focus on a specific task. Now, the neural conditioning chart you see in the outline can be applied here. In the emotional triggers column, you'll want to think about and list the situations that may instantly induce an emotional reaction. Look at that and work on that in your own time. We don't have time to go through all of that, but that's a micro system for dealing with emotional triggers, to recognize the emotional triggers, to recognize also the immediate behavior that it induces, the state change of the negative self-talk, all the things that are the usual behavior, column two, to then, as soon as you recognize it and cue your radar for this, to develop a focus, a focus phrase, and a relaxation to then pre-create that ideal response that you can move immediately to. Now, here's one brief overview of mental energy restoration for optimal performance. At times, we may view rest as passive, such as an athlete seeing it as not training. Dr. Sereni Pillay calls it unfocus. To frame rest and unfocused time as supporting achievement, to create a framework that's effective and proactive. This kind of rest is an active process, physiologically and psychologically. We do our best efforts with intense work, focus, followed by short breaks. The breaks become a part of the process. Sereni is a neuroscientist at Harvard Medical. I would highly recommend his book, Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try. He's become a collaborative buddy since we shared a presentation venue a couple of years ago, so I've very much followed his work. In one study, well, for example, if you're doing cognitive work, the ideal period of intense focus and rest is 6 minutes of rest for every hour. When you do that with a walk in nature, you'll be 60% more productive the next hour. That sounds pretty hard to believe, but this is what the research shows. If, as he is in Boston, if you can only go to the window and look out in nature for those 6 minutes, then you're 40% more effective the next hour. Every area, there are many, many arenas of work about an optimum balance. And in this instance of 54 minutes, 6 minutes, and agricultural workers, it's 75 minutes and 17 minutes a break. There's everything all the way down to what's optimal for people in meat packing plants. This has been studied. So now let's look at playing to win versus playing not to lose. We seek pleasure by playing to win. We avoid pain by playing not to lose. When you play not to lose, you most likely assure loss because this shifts the operating system of the brain. The brain has two separate neurochemical systems and pathways. One neural system is wired to seek pleasure by winning. The other system is wired to avoid mistakes and curtail risk, to avoid pain, to play not to lose. So when you play not to lose, you engage the negative avoidant mindset. So if you play to win with gain orientation to seek pleasure, we may take risk, look for potential reward. Prevention orientation, on the other hand, generates caution to avoid risk. So this is an application of seeing a situation as a challenge versus a threat. Two different mindsets, two different levels of performance results. In one summary, some of the distinctions of playing to win versus playing not to lose. Playing to win is based in confidence. Playing not to lose is based in fear. Playing to win optimizes performance. Playing not to lose, defensive. Playing to win, thriving and superiority. Playing not to lose, surviving and mediocre. Playing to win creates special experiences and memories. Playing not to lose frames stressful experiences and moments. And importantly, playing to win optimizes abilities. Playing not to lose compromises expression of those abilities. So let's look now at some performance anxiety management. Remember, performance can depend on whether you interpret anxiety or excitement. When viewed as a necessary component to boost performance, excitement, activation can fuel optimum performance. So focus needs to remain on the state of flow and the successful execution of the skill, whatever its nature. So let's consider four most common success completion issues: choking, sandbagging, self-handicapping and burnout, and how to prevent each. First, choking. When Jackie Robinson grabbed his throat in a game between St. Louis and the Dodgers, when umpire Bill Stewart badly missed a call, this was back, I think, in 1953, Stewart threw him out of the game. choking became a common term for blowing it. Choking usually refers to not executing a special skill or a specific skill under pressure that you would more likely execute in normal situations. So some common scenarios of choking: botching a routine behavior, such as catching a pass in a big game, flubbing a well-practiced presentation, forgetting lines that an actor has said hundreds of times, blanking on the name of someone the person knows quite well. Or I would even include, since all of these are illustrations of a state change, writer's block. Understanding how choking happens will help reduce its occurrence and promote optimum performance. So here are two particular behaviors that increase pressure and distort the ability to perform under pressure. And I say these because you can listen for them in class. Framing a situation as a unique experience. This is my biggest game. There'll never be an opportunity like this. Today I make history. Thinking of a pressure moment as a single shot heightens the sense of risk and loss. With athletes, loss aversion creates a behavior of playing not to lose. An example, in the 2017 American League Baseball Championships, the starting Astros pitcher in Game 3 against the Yankees was Charlie Martin. That's back in the day when I followed and liked the Astros. When he was interviewed before the game, he said, "This is the biggest game of my life." My response at that time as an Astros fan was, "Uh-oh." The Yankees got 6 runs in the first 2 innings. Now, see how right my grandmother was? If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. And second is exaggerating a situation, becoming too attached to the outcome, intensifying thoughts of fear and anxiety, especially focusing on failure versus success. Anxiety itself can cause a shift of state so that you lose that performance flow and zone. Remember, the meaning we ascribe to an event then determines our response. And that creates both pressure and stress, or the avoidance of it, to optimize performance. So how we change the way we view anxiety and pressure can change the impact of our performance. One example, in research examining 185 venture capital pitches, like you see on Shark Tank, variables such as calmness, passion, eye contact, and confidence were greater predictors of outcome than the combined content, experience, and expertise. 2, self-handicaps. Dr. Eddie O'Connor reports the recognition of his process of self-handicapping as a runner. He recognized, in not reaching his goal for the half mile in 2:10, that he was holding back to have something left at the end of each race, coupled with the hope that he could get there the next time by trying harder. It's kind of a way he preserved hope. He recognized, though, that preserving the hope of doing better was actually interfering with doing better. Self-handicaps are performance barriers or inhibitions created to protect someone's self-esteem and confidence. If there's failure, the self-talk can then become, well, it isn't because of poor ability, but some outside circumstance. I can always try harder. The remedy for self-handicaps? Self-reflection and awareness of this process. 3, sandbagging. Sandbagging attempts to demonstrate in some way a limitation or negative aspect to diminish expectations of you by others. Sandbagging is designed to diminish the pressure of performance anxiety. In one study, which is representative, sandbaggers who predicted lesser performance actually made it a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, I may have lost, but it doesn't really count because I didn't try. So both self-handicapping and sandbagging are designed to preserve integrity and avoid pain, yet they both produce the results they most attempt to avoid. A specific remedy for sandbagging? Self-reflection to recognize, own, assess, and decide what to do, and changing self-talk. 4, burnout. Burnout is a syndrome comprised of a collection of aspects that include a diminished emotional drive, concentration, motivation, and enthusiasm for an endeavor. It's often the result of a chronic experience of stressful performance. Someone experiences tension, fatigue, and lethargy in a sustained way, along with a lessened desire to engage with passion and consistency. The remedy for burnout: mindfulness with reappraisal and re-engagement. Objective measures of effectiveness are an important component of self-monitoring and performance assessment that can avoid burnout. I want to refer you, rather than going through these in detail, the list of the pressure management tools in your outline. These are a strategy to regulate pressure moments, and some of these may be useful at particular times. Regulating a state of mind and perhaps reframing pressure of the moment is important to focus and guide behavior. So, some considerations include, and I'll just highlight some major ones here. Get grounded and centered. Recall previous successes. That boosts up a positive mindset. Reframe the pressure moment as a challenge and opportunity. Reflect on the purpose. That sustains anchoring. Create a positive vision of the outcome before and in preparation. Consider each situation as an opportunity to develop and improve. Confidence is a state of mind. Confidence determines how we engage something. So keep ideals and positive attributes in focus, and sustain focus on what you can determine. It may be necessary to reset a number of times, or to do your cue or focus phrase a number of times, and use that mantra component to stay grounded. Train or practice under pressure conditions. Remember, I gave the example of Roger Reed and how they went from 217 to number one in free throw percentage because they developed the mantra and they practiced in game situations. They practiced like they were going to play. And the last one, this introduces the roadmap system for performing under pressure. So this is in your outline. And what I would suggest you do is to schedule an appointment with yourself to treat this as an exercise. Return, as you prepare for it, to your neural conditioning chart. Work with the first emotional trigger you wrote. Go through these seven steps and look at that emotional trigger as a component of your story to illustrate a roadmap for a state of mind of performing under pressure. And again, this is a macro system to look at the algorithms that comprise a story. This is for us as mentor coaches to find a way to listen to a story, to look at the components, because all the algorithms, behavior, cognitive, emotional, they're going to manifest in ways that you'll see. This is simply a way for listening to the components to sort of be able, with a client, to deconstruct how the client puts together a story, to look at what's working, what's not, how to focus on an aspect that may need some attention. So these seven steps are the summary of looking at and understanding a story to see what needs to be changed, improved, or how to create a new story. So just in a one-minute overview, picking that emotional trigger, recognize how the emotional trigger changes your state of mind, how it immediately moves you into that column two. Observe the state change in that column two, beliefs, doubts, anxiety, negative self-talk, that content will never change. It's a time capsule. And by definition, a time capsule will never change. That's why people get stuck in therapy trying to redo or undo or work through or have catharsis. All of that won't change, but you can avoid falling into that time capsule by the recognition and moving to column three, getting grounded and centered, the cue, the focus, the physiology. Access an ideal state of mind, column three, the mantra to get grounded and centered, to enter an optimum state. Then, as you move to column four, decide on a predetermined strategy, maybe which pressure management tool or an ideal response or behavior. Then you can map, R-O-A-D-M, map, the next best challenge. A challenge violates the default story expectation. So an ideal performance plan is developed with deliberate practice. So map the next best action. Author that ideal response. Execute the optimum performance. And then finally, programmed your peak performance identity. This is what makes change permanent. This is what we hope to do with every client, to help them transform the model of how and who they are, the way they see themselves, their identity, because our identities are what we always return to. If we do a different behavior and don't transform that into an identity, we'll revert back to the way we used to do things. To transform how and who you see yourself, doing and being in that performance zone, incorporate the new behavior as part of your core self. One of the most powerful forces of the human psyche is we always return to our core identity. You know, it's kind of like when someone trips, you hear their native language. When new behavior is incorporated into core identity, it becomes over time permanent. It's metabolized. It becomes transformed. Change that lasts becomes that default mode. Your brain has rewired. This is what makes change permanent. And back to the neuroconditioning chart, as you go through horizontally those four columns, you're ultimately, what was the emotional trigger will be rewired to an optimum behavior, but it needs to be repeated and repeated consistently. So we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested to hear thoughts or questions or anything you'd like to discuss a bit further about anything we talk about. If you'd stay on mute and then unmute before you comment or add anything. I'm eager to hear from you. What you got?
Dave, this is Kip.
Hey, Kip. Welcome. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great, man. Thank you. I wanted
great.
To,
how was that burgundy? Go ahead.
Yeah,
I won't call you out. Go ahead.
Okay. So the stop, could you say what each letter means again? And I think you said that was for mindfulness focus.
Yeah, it's just a simple way to think about a quick version of mindfulness meditation. The STOP is the acronym. STOP, in other words, in any negative thought or what, stop. Take a breath. Breathe in deeply, relaxation, breathe out any tension. Observe that breath, not the thoughts, not the things that are interfering, but just refocus on that breath, just like mindfulness meditation, and then proceed. It's just an immediate way to do a mindfulness meditation in about 3 seconds and on the go. Stop, take a breath. Observe and proceed. Make sense?
Perfect.
Okay,
thank
great.
You.
All right. Super. Thank you, Kip. Appreciate that. Other thoughts, questions, or things you'd like to add or ask or clarify? I hope that I'm really addressing the things that those of you, and I appreciate so much so many of you sending in the things that you wanted to be sure that we include and objectives for the end. Again, we'll have a discussion for longer at the end of next seminar, so plan if you're interested to hang around, and we'll have more of a discussion. But anything else we've got? Well, we're really out of time, but I'll take one other question if there are any questions or comments. Well, I hope that we'll have a lively discussion at the end of our last seminar next time. See you there, and bring any questions, thoughts, or comments that you have, and we'll launch into those. So have a great rest of the week, and take good care of yourselves. Bye now. See you guys.